It's KRCB's A Novel Idea.
This is a poem by Kabir, translated by Robert Bly, music by John Abercrombie. I said to the wanting creature inside me, "What is this river you want to cross? There are no travelers on the river road, and no road. Do you see anyone moving about on that bank or resting? There is no river at all, and no boat, and no boatman. There is no tow rope either, and no one to pull it. There is no ground, no sky, no time, no bank, no ford. And there is no body and no mind. Do you believe there is some place that will make the soul less thirsty? In that great absence, you will find nothing. Be strong then, and enter into your own body. There, you have a solid place for your feet. Think about it carefully. Don't go off somewhere else." Kabir says this: "Just throw away all thoughts of imaginary things and stand firm in that which you are."
Jazz musician and jazz music publisher Chuck Scheer has just released Poetry and Jazz, A Magical Marriage. And we've just heard a piece from it, Unnamed Poem by Kabir, translated by Robert Bly and read by Coleman Barks to John Abercrombie, performing Still from his album Current Events. Some of you may know Chuck as a radio personality. He has been one of the regular hosts of KRCB's Jazz Connections for many, many years, bringing listeners some great, moving, exciting music. Later in the broadcast, we'll also hear from Sonoma County poet Raphael Bloch. Raphael has performed with musicians before and, in fact, has had one of his poems transformed into a choral piece and performed by the Occidental Community Choir. And we'll get to know Raphael a bit better, so stay with us. It's A Novel Idea. Poetry and Jazz, A Magical Marriage, is just that, a compilation of world-class poetry, Rilke, Rumi, Rex Roth, accompanied by world-class jazz compositions and read by a dynamic group of readers. Let's listen to Alison Luderman's Stripping.
Stripping by Alison Luderman. Music by Keith Javers. Strip off the shoes and pantyhose, the grown-up drag. Undo those soft white arms and their blonde down, moss made of light. Wash away the sour sweat, fatigue of heels and fluorescent lights. Unhook that tired bra. Release the feet with their worn-out travel logs, knees complaining in their bone cradles. The drooling sex and the shamed belly pouched like a stubborn mountain. Release the years in a shower of moths shaken free from an old sweater. So full of holes, you can see through to the skin. Strip off the skin. Let it hang over a chair the way it has hung from your body lately, exhausted, confessing to years of experience. Strip away experience, that false umbrella blocking the only sun. strip your mind of these words. Clods of dirt kicked up by donkey mind. Clouds that will soon pass. Let the clang of language die in your mouth. Let your overworked tongue hang, innocent and dumb as tomorrow morning. No one owns it yet, that paper mini dress of time, meant to be cast off after one wearing. It's the jewel at the center I seek. Let me be oyster, hoarding pearl. Let me be coal, sheltering diamond. Though in my heart of hearts, I fear I may be onion. Each white circle of stinky tears hiding another exactly like it. Or a rose, whose petals are her everything.
We've just heard Alison Luderman's Stripping, read by Renee Marie to Keith Javers' Sevens, from his album From Here to the Streets, another piece from Poetry and Jazz, a Magical Marriage, produced by Chuck Scheer and distributed by Scheer Music Company. I sat down with Chuck recently. Let's listen to that conversation. Chuck Scheer, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Our listeners have heard you before when you've been a guest on this show, but many of our listeners may be familiar with you because you're a longtime host of KRCB's Jazz Connections.
One of several.
One of several. And you are a musician, a bass player, and have been playing with groups, but notably the One World Orchestra.
That band is now defunct. My current band is called the No Name All Stars, and we play down at the No Name Bar in Sausalito.
Well, good. Evolution.
Yeah.
And last time we had a conversation, and I don't remember if it was on the air or not, but you were very excited to be putting your own writing to music.
That's how it started. Although the CD that finally got released, called Poetry Plus Jazz, A Magical Marriage, has one piece of mine, but all the rest of them, the other 22 are by much better poets than me, Rainer Maria Rilke and Rumi and Kenneth Rexroth and Philip Levine and Alison Luderman, and on and on.
And that is why we're here today, to talk about your just released CD that you're calling an audiobook. And it is a magical marriage between poetry and music. And in my mind, it started with you and your work putting to music. And now here's this full-blown piece of work. Just tell me about the evolution of this as a project that you've undertaken.
Sure, yeah. The most interesting thing was how it started, which was completely by accident. I'd been writing poetry for a while, and one day I happened to have a piece of music on that felt like one of the poems I'd written. So I started the music again and started reading with that in the background. And I knew they would get along together because they're the same emotional terrain, but I was not prepared at all for what happened, which was that the music just wrapped itself around the words. Sometimes line by line, the words would change and boom, the music would change with it. It was spooky and very beautiful, actually. And then it turned out that it wasn't a fluke at all, that happened over and over with dozens of the things I'd written. And it just blew my mind. It's really a magical thing it was. At that point, I was studying poetry with Alison Luderman, great East Bay poet, and I started putting some of her work to music, and that was even more beautiful because her poems are serious high art, and there's three of her pieces on the CD here. And then that led to doing the same thing for Rumi and Rainer Maria Rilke and all the other people on there. So it
started with your own work and then evolved in a way.
Yeah.
And what I love about it is that as a listener to these pieces, it adds to our appreciation and knowledge of both the music and the poetry. For instance, I was not familiar with Alison Luderman. Yes. I wasn't familiar with her work before, but was blown away by what I heard.
Yeah,
and so, so it's introducing me to somebody I didn't know, mm-hmm. and opening up poetry, perhaps for people who maybe don't engage with it on the page.
Right. I never did either. This is all pretty new to me, but I started writing just out of some inner necessity. And once I started writing, then that got me interested in reading people who actually did have some talent. And so and at this point, I've read hundreds of poetry books, a lot of anthologies and stuff to try to pull things out of there to use for this project.
I am wondering then, this is a curated CD, an audiobook, and how did you do that curation? To me, it seems like you had to select or commission or entice readers that perhaps the poem resonated with them. And then you had music, and at what stage did you join the music to the writing, or were they listening to the music during the recording? Because the recordings are just beautiful. So tell me a little bit about that process.
Well, they were all, I did rough drafts of all of these things.
With you as the reader?
Yeah, with me as the reader. But I'm not a great public speaker, and so I knew I had to find one or more people to bring out the real beauty that I knew was there. And then, you know, this whole project, it's got energy from some other dimension in it. How the music and the words fit together, it didn't come from me, it came through me, if you know what I mean. And then this other magical thing happened, which was that I knew I needed a great reader. And one day, a tennis buddy of mine in Petaluma, whose name is Corey Burr, he gave me a Christmas present of him reciting Dylan Thomas's A Child's Christmas in Wales. And I was just astounded with how beautiful his ability to bring out the beauty of the poem was. One of the world's great readers, Corey is. So I went down to McNair Tennis Court where he played, and I brought my iPhone. I said, "Hey, brother, come on over here and listen to what I've done here." And he really dug it. And then we just went in the studio, and he recorded the same thing I'd done, but with great equipment, and came out sounding like $1 million, as I knew it would, because it was meant to be this whole project. Corey's a brilliant, absolutely a brilliant voice actor. And Corey, I'll have to say, you know, he's a professional actor in his past, doesn't do that anymore, but he was really cooperative and friendly and helpful and very willing to take suggestions. And that really helped.
And was he listening to the music while he was reading, or did you do that coupling?
No, well, like I said, it already existed. Mm-hmm. And so he was reading to the music just like I did, which in some cases was crucial because the music gives the right feeling that I was trying to evoke out of the poem. And I don't think we could have done it any other way.
And tell us a little bit about some of the other readers who you worked with on this endeavor.
Yes. Corey is the main reader on the CD. I think he does 13 out of the 23 tracks. But then there were some things I felt needed a different voice, just for variety, for one. And also, certain things just seemed like it required somebody who lived in that world, the Rumi things in particular. So I figured, well, who's better equipped to do the Rumi things than Coleman Barks, who is Rumi's most loved translator? And Coleman was very approachable. I just called him, emailed him, I forget which happened first, and asked him if he wanted to be part of this project and sent him the first couple of tracks we'd done, and he said, yeah, he'd be happy to. So he's on three of the tracks, I believe. Then there were certain pieces that, like Alison Luderman's, that had to be read by a woman. It took a while to find a great woman reader who was up to Corey's level, but I finally did. She's actually a great jazz singer named Renee Marie. She was nominated for a Grammy last year. A wonderful singer and a great performer, and it turns out she's a great actress, too. She just dove into these things, and it made it sound like she was born for that, too. So I'm just thrilled. Then I do one piece, and then there's one by Frank Ostaseski, who runs an institution in Sausalito called the Metta Institute that trains hospice workers in a Buddhist sort of perspective on hospice work. And Frank has a beautiful voice. We just heard him at, my wife and I heard him at Spirit Rock one night. And I said, boy, Frank, besides being a beautiful person, has a great voice.
It seems like you have been involved with jazz music
pretty much all my life, one way or another.
Right, right. And that this kind of direction seems to have really captured you. And tell me how the poetry inflects the music.
Well, the music's already set. We're not improvising here. These are recordings by Maria Schneider and Stan Getz and Claire Fisher and a bunch of other people, John Patitucci. So the music didn't change. That was the fixed thing. I know in doing the rough drafts, what I felt like was that the music, even with horn players and all that, the music was the rhythm section and I was the soloist. And so I'd wait for the music the way a good horn player does. He waits for the rhythm section to lay down a new chord or whatever, and then he'll start based on the feeling that that evokes. And that's just what I did. It was a lot of fun to do. If I had the money, I'd be in the studio every day, you know.
Well, I think sometimes jazz can be very accessible, but to some people, maybe not so much. And though I will say, whenever I listen to your selections on Jazz Connections, I think that they're just perfect. So, but I think for some listeners, it could open up the music in a way that maybe they hadn't experienced before.
Yes, I certainly hope so. You know, jazz music is a big tent. There's so much in there. And people who haven't been exposed to much of it, they mostly consider it to be just a bunch of notes that don't have any way to hang with each other. It's all over their heads or whatever. And, you know, so jazz music is a minority taste. Most people don't really understand it and have no real interest in it. But what happened on this CD is because the music is being used as a platform for the words, I found myself choosing music that was more orchestral in nature. But, you know, as I said, jazz music is a big tent, and there's so much beauty in there that most people just have no idea. And I'm hoping, among other things, that when people hear Stan Getz playing You're Blasé with these words that are just perfectly attuned to the music, that they'll actually be motivated to go out and buy a couple Stan Getz records. You know, there's so much beauty in music in general and jazz music in particular that the world would be a better place. I can tell you, I was watching TV the other day and they put on this thing called a hot dog eating contest. And there are these guys stuffing 50 hot dogs into their mouths with buns and all in 12 minutes. It's completely gross, right? And so, you know, figure, you know, people are allowed to be stupid and that's all right. But then they turned the camera on the crowd and there was 10,000 people watching them. I couldn't believe it. You know, it's like there's it's such a divergent culture. There's so much beauty and there's so much absolute absurdity in it. So I feel obligated to promote the beauty part of it because life is beautiful itself, and our obligation to reflect that, I believe.
Well, that's beautiful, Chuck, because when you talk about some of the inane activities that we call entertainment, or even pay to see, and it almost seems like they're designed to take us away from the soulful beauty that is in ourselves and in each other, and that is expressed through poetry and music. And it's been confounding to me.
Yes.
I don't get it, but...
It's an ambivalent thing, culture, American culture in particular.
Yeah. I noticed that you have several pieces by Rilke.
Mm-hmm.
And is he a favorite of yours? Or tell me what draws you.
Well, you know, like I said, I'd never read too much poetry, but Jacob Needleman, who we co-interviewed on the show a few years ago, in a thing he wrote, he read, or it was written in this piece that he did. It was actually a commencement address for a high school. And so he read this Rilke poem in the course of this commencement address, and it was just beautiful, called The Man Watching. And that's on the CD here. And so there was something really special about that, and that led me to go buy a couple of books of Rilke's poetry, and then I found some incredible things. The one thing that's on here, the last piece on the CD, is the Ninth Duino Elegy. And the Duino Elegies, all of them, but particularly the ninth one, are very special pieces. I've read that he wrote them in something like a trance, that the words came through him. He didn't sit there and figure out anything. They just came out. And then I'm sure he, fine-tuned it later, but the basic nuts and bolts of it was, he was like a medium for these messages from somewhere else. And actually, that piece in particular, if you try to listen to it or read it literally, there are a bunch of things in there that make no sense. So you have to let it wash over you. And the music really helps with that, because the music pulls you forward into the piece. And that actually happens in most of these pieces, I guess. And I really feel blessed and honored to be the conduit for these marriages, because they make both the music and the words something more beautiful than they would have been by themselves.
Is there anything else you want to talk about the curating of this?
I spent a lot of time, because I'm a jazz programmer, so I spent a lot of time making sure that the order of things flowed well, because that's what I do on my show anyway. The basic principle being that every track should be a relief somehow from the one before, either up or down or sideways or some other way. So I spent a lot of time. At this point, it's perfect. I wouldn't change a note of it ever, So.
Poetry and jazz, a magical marriage. And how can our listeners get a hold of this CD?
It's on our website, which is shermusic.com, S-H-E-R. It's also on Amazon, on iTunes. It's available both as a physical CD and a digital download. And hopefully it'll be in record stores. I'm a book publisher, so I know my distributors will be selling it to music stores. So it might be in your local music store, where however many of those are left. It's a tough environment for music stores. A lot of competition from the internet.
And the internet is also a good way to access this. So,
yes. Well, like I said, our website, you can buy it there and download it there. I think it's $15 for the physical CD and $12 for the download.
And at your website, they will you'll be exposed to a lot of Chuck's other work as well. As a music publisher, you have a whole body of work.
That's right.
That is kind of interesting. I'm not a musician, but it fascinates me.
We're the high end of the jazz publishing world. We do the best work of anybody, if I don't say so myself. And jazz musicians all over the world love our books because I'm a musician myself, so I know what works and I know what people need on the stand when they're playing a chart. So it's been a perfect little business for me because I know what I'm talking about.
And now maybe there's a whole new audience out there for this project of yours, Poetry and Jazz, A Magical Marriage. An audiobook produced by Chuck Scheer, and it sounds great. It sounds fabulous. Thanks a lot, Chuck.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You are listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. I am Suzanne Lang, and I have been talking with Chuck Scheer on his recently released audiobook, Poetry and Jazz, A Magical Marriage. Let's take a short break and listen to the Maria Schneider Orchestra with Walking by Flashlight from her work, The Thompson Fields. Stay with us. Coming up next, Raphael Bloch. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is listener-supported KRCB's A Novel Idea. Poet Raphael Bloch is the author of the critically acclaimed Songs from a Small Universe and the more recently released Spangling Darkness. His work is grounded in nature while exploring our human emotions. I'm here talking with Raphael Bloch, local Sonoma County writer and poet. We've talked about getting together for some time, so I'm glad that we're in the studio together. And you have a new book just out of poems, and to go along with your previous relief of Songs from a Small Universe. But tell us about your new release, Spangling Darkness.
Well, Spangling Darkness, I'm very pleased with the way it's come out, both thanks to the editor, John of Poetic Matrix, who has a wonderful design, wonderful texture of the cover, but also it carries 8 very fine drawings that I was able to get a print company to reproduce separately. So as well, one can, as with each book, download a really top quality recording of the poems being recited by myself. So it's a sort of multimedia. I'm really happy that it's visual, auditory, and hopefully in pleasing written form too.
So is that something new for you to have illustrations accompanying your work?
It is. A friend in London, a very talented artist, Claire Allen, drew these fantastic illustrations. She had a totally free hand, and she responded to 8 of the poems. And I'd seen her work in another book, and she just did it out of friendship and love for the work.
So that really is a true collaboration, that her inspiration for the piece was based on your work.
Indeed. The best collaborations I've had, as another example in this book, is one of the poems, When I Look at the Stars, was turned into a choral piece by Sarah Salisbury. And it's one of the songs at the back of the book. Each book I produce has a number of songs, and it's the transcript, the musical transcript is there for, to start off the 4 parts. And she was inspired. She read through the manuscript at my request and made some lovely comments. And the song just happened to grow in her. And one day she called me up and said, "I hope you don't mind, but I'm composing a song from one of your poems." And of course, I was very flattered. I didn't mind at all. And it was a great joy to sing it with the choir, too.
And so that has been performed by the Occidental Choir?
It has, When I Look at the Stars, yeah.
And can our listeners listen to that via your website?
I do have it on a CD that the Occidental Community Choir performed, which is available on the website, along with a much more current CD where I work with 2 musicians and have done for many years. One of them is a very close friend, Bhavani Judith Tucker, who's a multi-instrumentalist. And we collaborate with another friend, David Field, a guitarist. He's become a friend. I didn't know him originally. And we present the poetry with music. And they're woven together. So, you know, we don't just stand up and do our thing. We actually rehearse and decide on an appropriate melody for each particular poem. And then within that framework, we're able to improvise to a degree. So I think the result is both spontaneous and deep. And we manage, thanks to Phil Lawrence, a very talented mandolin player. He recorded us a couple of summers ago and is featured on that CD too.
And you have also done some live performances with Phil Lawrence. So you have a history of
with these books collaborating across medium in a way. And does that add to your experience of kind of coming outside of the work in a way?
It's I regard the work as really not belonging to me, but I regard each piece as a gift, and I develop it as far as I can, and often it has to be left a number of years, and then I come back to it. But the point of a gift, as far as I can see, is to share it. And so the joy is in sharing it with people. And I think many people are much more open to music or poetry and music combined than they might be to just a poetry reading, though I also do those. And it's also a lot of fun to do it that way, frankly.
You've been pretty candid about your influences in writing, in your personal influences through your life, of your loss of your wife and of your own personal health situation. And when you talk about healing powers, it seems like that's all entwined. And I'm wondering if you could address that a little bit.
Yes. Thank you for asking. We all know about opposites, and so, you know, a loss is simultaneously a gain in a different sense. Of course, you know, an example of my wife, I miss her terribly, but also she left me, or I was left by, call it spirit or beloved or whatever, a tremendous amount of love, and had the privilege of raising our daughter, who was only 11 years old at the time. So it's often the wonderful thing is, and I know many people who've had, you know, extreme adverse circumstances, perhaps, you know, as children or even as adults. It's how to turn them around so it becomes a source of vibrant spirit and joy and embraces sorrow too. And my Crohn's disease, listeners may be more familiar with colitis, but Crohn's affects one's intestines. And I've had two operations so far in my life and may be facing a third one soon. It's always been a great teacher to me. Since 2008, it's been in the forefront of my life, and I had to medically retire from teaching. It's basically, you know, we all know someone who's either had cancer or has cancer. As any life-threatening illness, it really makes one appreciate each day. It gives a certain edge. Perhaps you're walking on a tightrope, but it makes every day wonderful and a gift in its own right. And I may be feeling terrible physically, but I'm still really glad to be alive for that day and appreciate it in all kinds of small ways, whether it's simply going out into the garden and seeing the birds or what's flowering and all the leaves falling. It's all quite wonderful. And so the experiences such as having Crohn's disease, they really, in a certain sense, whet one's appetite and appreciation for life. And of course, you have to home in on what's really important, because I don't have the energy to spend chasing around all the desires I had as a young man. And I wouldn't want them anyway. I just go after what's feels truly important to me each day, which includes poetry, walking, meditation, and friends, basically. You know, that's it in a nutshell.
Can you tell us a little bit about your process as a writer?
Yes. Often the writing starts, and Mary Oliver has described this similarly. I basically go on the same walk almost every day, just up my street, lovely uphill. It's west of Sebastopol. And I'm observing, and I've actually taken up recently bird spotting thanks to my daughter's enthusiasm. She's actually a very avid bird spotter and is researching sparrows in Santa Cruz. But I'm a little more modest in my approach. It's a little ironic. I now have only one eye, and I'm really enjoying binoculars. And it doesn't matter if I can identify the bird or not. It's still enjoyable to watch. But I have, thanks to my daughter's education, learned to identify a lot more of the local birds. And so paying attention and observing, if one is lucky, and there are walks where it happens, where my mind finally drops its shopping list and whatever else is plaguing it, then something else can enter. And I carry a little notebook and a pencil, and I'll jot down whatever it is. It may be the beginning of a promising poem, or it may not lead anywhere. But either way, it's paying attention to what's happening. And that is often the genesis of many of my poems. But they also happen sitting at my desk, looking out the window, or in the middle of the night, something will come. There are a number of poems that came to me when I was in hospital in 2008. I also include human nature, which, you know, my relationships, people I've known who've touched me. So some of them, the poems feel very intimate, at least to me. And I hope that you know, my aim is that once I've usually do a couple of drafts handwritten, and then I get on the computer, which it's much easier to revise poems. And I work for considerable time on the revision until it feels it's reached as far as it wants to go. And then you kind of lay it to rest and come back a few years later. It needs time to kind of mature as wine in the barrel. And often when one comes back to a piece, then fresh ideas come that can lift it to a different plane. So that's basically the process. I work in the mornings. I don't have any absolutely set routine, but I like to spend at least an hour each day on that. And then I kind of run out of steam. It does require a lot of focused energy and inspiration to propel a piece forward and just to stay in touch with it. And then I turn to other activities.
And in this steeping process, then they are ready for publication, or how do you do that process, or are you working with your editor to curate what goes into that volume? And you mentioned that you're coming out with another book yet, and so how do you do that kind of balancing of how you put the material out for readers?
For each of the first two books, there was a point where I felt in the folders that I keep on my computer that was a natural terminal point, and I just had to print all the poems and make a final selection and shuffle them around, basically lay them on the floor in a good large space and start to group them, because each book has kind of natural sections. In Spangling Darkness, for instance, there are four sections. And it's important to me then to have a lead poem for each section. It often gives the name to the section. The first section is called Spangling Darkness, and the second, Soft Flickerings, and the third, When a Chill Sea Wind, and the fourth, Earth Dances, and then there's a section of songs. And then Terry Blesser will comment on the individual poems and the arrangement, and then the final say happens, as happened with John Peterson, the publisher. In order to arrange the books, so, you know, it's just a technical matter to have a poem that takes over two pages, which I don't have very many of those, and to fit an illustration in, you may need to change the order a little bit just so that it works as a book and doesn't have blank pages in the middle. So that's the process. I find it fun revising. To me, it's incredibly spellbinding. But way before they reach a book, you know, I might send them to our Larry Robinson, a local email poem a day, or other avenues. I've had a number published now in Sufi Journal, which does a fantastic job of combining photography with poetry. I don't know of any other journal that does such a fine job of that. As long as one poem touches one person, then from my point of view, it's done its job.
Well, congratulations on seeing Spangling Darkness into a lovely book and a lot of good work. Thanks for coming in today.
Oh, thanks so much, Suzanne, for inviting me, and wish you well as always with this great program.
Raphael has performed with musicians such as Bhavani Judith Tucker and Phil Lawrence, and has had his work inspire choral arrangements. When I asked him to read me something, he spontaneously broke into song.
Perfume. This spirit breath leaves and enters quite unbidden. Traveling light, it bears only essence. Let this perfume soak in your warmth and pleasantness. Each day and night of a microscopic life, let this perfume soak in your warmth and pleasantness. Each day and night of our lives.
Raphael Bloch's a cappella version of Perfume. Earlier in the broadcast, I spoke with Chuck Scher on his audio CD, Poetry and Jazz, A Magical Marriage. Let's go out with On Living by Nazim Hikmet, read by Corey Burr.
On Living by Nazim Hikmet, who was a political prisoner for many years. Music by Kalman Ola and Trio Midnight. Living is no laughing matter. You must live with great seriousness, like a squirrel, for example. I mean, without looking for something beyond and above living. I mean, living must be your whole occupation. Living is no laughing matter. You must take it seriously, so much so, and to such a degree that, for example, your hands tied behind your back, your back to the wall. Or else, in a laboratory, in your white coat and safety glasses, you can die for people, even for people whose faces you've never seen, even though you know living is the most real, the most beautiful thing. I mean, you must take living so seriously that even at 70, for example, you'll plant olive trees. And not for your children either, but because although you fear death, you don't believe it. Because living, I mean, weighs heavier. Let's say we're seriously ill, need surgery, which is to say we might not get up from the white table. Even though it's impossible not to feel sad about going a little too soon, we'll still laugh at the jokes being told. We'll look out the window to see if it's raining, or still wait anxiously for the latest newscast. Let's say we're at the front, for something worth fighting for, say. There, in the first offensive on that very day, we might fall on our face dead. We'll know this with a curious anger, but we'll still worry ourselves to death about the outcome of the war. which could last years. Let's say we're in prison and close to 50, and we have 18 more years, say, before the iron doors will open. We'll still live with the outside, with its people and animals, struggle and wind. I mean with the outside beyond the walls. I mean however and wherever we are, we must live as if we will never die. This earth will grow cold, a star among stars, and one of the smallest, a gilded mote on blue velvet. I mean this, our great earth, this earth will grow cold one day, not like a block of ice or a dead cloud even, but like an empty walnut. It will roll along in pitch black space. You must grieve for this right now. You have to feel this sorrow now, for the world must be loved this much if you're going to say, I lived.
I'm Suzanne Lang. This is KRCB's A Novel Idea, produced by Lit Radio for KRCB Public Media, with production assistance from Sean Knight. You can listen to our podcasts at krcb.org and subscribe and listen through iTunes. And we'll close the show with another piece from the Maria Schneider Orchestra called Home. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you.